following is a state secret, gentlemen. Disclose it to any party and you will be subject to prosecution.
From Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer, the producers of Top Gun and Crimson Tide, and Michael Bay, the director of Bad Boys. This summer, get ready to rock.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome, Junkions, to another very exciting episode of
Junk
Food Cinema.
Oh, God, this is why you wanted to do this episode, just so you could hear your fucking voice.
Oh, it's going to be both. I'm going to be doing both Nicolas Cage and Sean Connery throughout this whole episode,
me.
So get the fuck used to it. This is the weekly cult and exploitation filmcast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and joining me, as per usual, is my friend and co-host, novelist, screenwriter, Lieutenant of Megaforce.
And guy who doesn't do any good impressions, so I will be the voice of sanity and reason on this
episode.
Wow,
how scary a turn of events is that?
I know.
That is a sentence spoken out loud without any irony.
Without irony.
Wow, which is how we like to run this show in general.
Yeah.
Because we like to talk about movies that, even though we know might not be the best films, may not academically fall under the category of great or classic.
May not be remembered or loved.
Yes.
But We
love them. We love these movies. We're not here to poke fun at bad movies. We're here to celebrate movies we love, regardless of their critical reception. And that is exactly what we're doing today. But if you would like to hear more of us doing that, you can check out our back catalog on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema as well.
You know, before we go on, I just got to say I really missed you last night. You were out of town, and I needed you.
Oh, okay. Well, is there more to that story, or are you just being romantic on the mic?
I was at the Alamo Drafthouse for a weird Wednesday, and there was this little thing on 35mm called Your Hunter from the Future. You weren't there.
Oh.
Like, it was like, there was, like, the, you know, Laird got up, and he's like, anybody, you know, anyone who's seen this film before, and, like, three of us were like, yeah! And he's like, oh, good. An audience of people who have no idea what they're in for. But I was like, I like, knew all three people, and it was like, and you weren't one of them. And it was like, nobody had any idea what they were in for. Like, they had not really, they knew that they'd heard that Your Hunter for the Future was a thing. They had no idea what a thing it was. And, oh,
yes.
My God. It was a beautiful 35mm print of Your Hunter from the Future. And so, you know, you just reminded me of that because you talked about our back catalog. I had just tweeted about this last night. It's like, go back and listen to that episode because, oh my God, Your Hunter from the Future. You need to be watching Your Hunter. And the thing is friends of ours who listened to the show had not listened to that episode and had no idea. They knew that we loved Your Hunter from the Future.
Mm-hmm.
But dear God.
I like to think of him as our Hunter from the Future, Cargill. So that's probably why you missed me when I wasn't there.
Your Hunter man of yesterday. Yes, there are so many jokes to plumb. But today we're not doing that because today we are talking about another deep fried beloved favorite of ours.
Yes. And what would make you beloved of me is if you really like this show, we have a little thing called Patreon that we utilize to allow you guys to subsidize what we do here. If you like what we do, go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, and for as little as $4 a month, you will get access to bonus content that includes us doing extra reviews, mailbags, me having to watch terrible movies. I'm recording a Rotor episode right now because I had to watch Rotor.
Rotor.
R-O-T-O-R. It's a really terrible RoboCop ripoff.
Oh, yeah. Who made you do that?
Some asshole. And you could be one of those assholes if you go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. But as Cargill mentioned, today's episode is extremely special. We are crossing off a number of items from our bucket list, the podcast bucket list. I mean, Cargill and I are both what you would call movie super freaks.
I think that's fair.
I think that's fair. And I don't know how, in the name of Zeus's butthole, we haven't covered The Rock.
There's a hostage situation on Alcatraz. Hostage, 81 tourist. The Rock's a tourist attraction.
A battery of VX gas rockets is presently deployed to deliver a highly lethal strike on the population of the San Francisco Bay Area.
Hiya. I'm an agent with the FBI. I'm Stanley Goodspeed.
But of course you are. At least he got his name right.
Now, all that stands between a city and a disaster.
The power of this chemical is way beyond anything you can imagine.
That's why you're coming with us.
Is a man who's never seen combat.
You're a chemical freak.
I'm a chemical super freak, actually.
And another who's been out of action for 30 years.
Show us on the blueprints.
I can't. My blueprint was in my head.
Fortunately, some things you never forget.
But don't worry. It'll all come back to me.
Welcome to The Rock.
We got visitors.
Sean Connery.
You sure you're ready for this?
I'll do my best.
Your best? Losers always whine about their best.
Yeah.
Nicolas Cage.
Listen, I'm just a biochemist. I drive a Volvo. A beige one. So what do you say you cut me some friggin' slack?
Ed Harris.
Fire.
This summer, get ready to rock.
You know, it's not only how have we not covered this, in watching this, rewatching this last night, it was like, oh God, there's so much to unpack and talk about here about this era of filmmaking and about how this movie plays in. And it opens a host of how the fuck did we not covers? Like, seriously, like, there's a whole... I feel like the reason why we haven't done this one yet is just because it just became 20 years old. That it's kind of just... It's now gone into... It's fallen into... This is a film of the past, of an era that's gone. And so we just thought it was too big of a recent movie. Like, everybody's seen The Rock and understands The Rock. But it's like, in terms of unpacking what it means for its era, what it means in terms of other films, and how we don't have films exactly like this anymore. Mm-hmm. It's such an interesting thing to talk about. But yeah, there's going to... those of you longtime junkies who know the drinking game, there's going to be about four or five times today where we're going to reference a movie and go, yeah, I'm surprised we haven't done that. We're going to be doing that in a future episode, and you know to take a drink.
Yep.
So those of you that don't, that's the drinking game. Whenever we say, we'll cover that in a future episode... take a drink. And that's going to happen a lot today. So get yourself a good beer, get yourself a glass of wine, get yourself a bottle of fine whiskey or scotch, and get ready to play along as we play The Rock.
The Rock. Yes. Welcome to Junk Food Cinema. Now have a drink. I think you're right. And in doing this episode, we are going to open a Pandora's box. Hey, like, there's your chance to do an impression. You said you couldn't do an impression this episode.
Oh, this is Pandora.
Yes. Yes.
Something, something, jujubes.
Something, something, jujubes.
And in fact, that was even worse than normal. Like, I do a pretty shit impression of him, and that was even worse than my normal shit impression. At least my normal shit impression is like, oh, I see what he's trying to do here. And that was just like, what? Is you mean the radio?
You'll get some pity claps. Digital radio. Yeah. This week's episode brought to you by that thing you don't listen to. But yeah, because we haven't covered any of the big Michael Bay films. I don't think we've covered really any Michael Bay films on this podcast.
And we haven't done the big Bruckheimers.
And the big Bruckheimers.
And in fact, I'm a huge fan of this era Bruckheimer. And in fact, we're going to talk about this.
Because you hate cars?
No, because the Jerry Bruckheimer of the mid-90s was so interesting.
I agree with
that. Like, this movie falls square in the middle of what I consider to be the great Jerry Bruckheimer trilogy. In which there are three films. The other films, again, we will cover.
Oh, yes. Sheathe your tweets.
Yes.
They're coming.
They're coming. Right.
Don't worry about it.
Where he decided he wanted to make these big budget action movies,
mm-hmm,
or big budget action dramas and techno thrillers that were morally ambiguous. And so we start off with one of my favorite movies of all time. This reminded me, like, the minute this started up and the theme song kicked in, I'm like, fuck, why are we covering this and not Crimson Tide? Like, ooh, why have we not done Crimson Tide? Crimson Tide is literally not only one of my favorite movies, it's the first movie that me and Scott really bonded over, you know, and got into our tremendous love of Tony Scott. This is a pseudo-sequel to Crimson Tide, followed up by G.I. Jane. Like, these three Bruckheimer movies all together really did... they all look the same. They all sound the same. They're by you know, Tony Scott, Ridley Scott, and here Michael Bay, and you really, really feel Bruckheimer's influence over the director. Like, this is easily Michael Bay's best film. It is
agreed.
It is arguably his best film. It is the
I would have that argument.
The closest you could come to disagreeing with that is if you said, yeah, but Bad Boys 2, though. And it's like, well, yeah, Bad Boys 2 is fucking awesome.
The but, argument is a tweet, Bad Boys 2, though.
Though, yes. Get a man who can do both. But if you're going to go meme-wise. So, yeah, but this is easily his best film. But as you watch this film and you watch more Michael Bay movies, you realize that this movie is less and less Michael Bay, and this movie is more and more about Jerry Bruckheimer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is a film that Michael Bay would never make this movie today. And
that's a sad fact.
It is a sad fact, but it's not because Michael Bay has gotten worse as a director. It's that you see that that Bruckheimer's influence here of this type of stories that Bruckheimer wanted to tell at the time and the influence that he was wielding over these movies, he wanted to tell really interesting stories that would work for anyone. And all three of these movies are about conservative ideologies butting head with liberal ideologies in very interesting ways. And he tells the stories in very interesting ways. And this one is so weird because... structurally speaking, this movie should not function.
Interesting.
It should not function, but it does. This movie's first act, technically from a structural standpoint, doesn't end until 48 minutes into the movie. We spend the first 25 minutes of the movie, we spend 2 minutes with one of our heroes and haven't met our other hero because technically speaking, they're not the movie's heroes. They're the audience's ciphers into this movie, but they're not really the heroes of this movie.
They are the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of the real story that's going on, which is the deep dive into the complex morality of the villain played by Ed Harris.
Who's not really a villain.
But that's what I'm saying.
Yes.
He's the reason. He's the Shakespearean figure that is this story.
Yes.
And Sean Connery and Nicolas Cage are on the periphery of that story.
I would call he is the movie's antagonist, but he's not the movie's villain.
Yes, correct.
And what's interesting is there are villains in this movie.
Yes.
There are villains, and those villains are not Ed Harris. And so, first of all, before we get into deep and
I know I'm already excited about how philosophical we're going to get talking about the goddamn rock. We are the reason this conversation is the reason this type of feeling that people have toward this movie is the reason it has a goddamn Criterion release.
Yes, because it is that good of a fucking movie. Like, the what this movie does story-wise is absolutely fascinating. Before we break that apart, let's talk about how this is like Tombstone in that it is one of those movies that has one of those greatest junkie casts this era.
One of whom is in Tombstone.
Yes. Yeah, no. And that connection stands. But literally, this is something that Bruckheimer did at the time. Bruckheimer had a nose for talent that was uncanny. This is not the greatest of Bruckheimer's achievements. The greatest of Bruckheimer's achievements would come 2 years later with Enemy of the State, in which Enemy of the State would have this group of young NSA NSA workers, you know, bees doing all this awful backroom shit, and it's like Jack Black and Seth Green and Scott Kahn, and like it's this really weird, like, what the fuck are these guys all doing as the background characters in this movie? And this movie has that with our Marines. So everybody knows this is. I mean, even if you haven't seen The Rock, which if you haven't. What the fuck,
why,
people?
Not only why are you listening to this episode, why are you still breathing my oxygen and walking this planet?
No.
Correct it immediately.
I won't be that angry.
No, I will.
You can't.
Correct it immediately. What is wrong with you?
It's on Netflix right now.
It could not be easier to get your hands on this movie.
It actually could be easier. It could also be for purchase and streaming through Amazon, which it is not because it's Netflix right now. You cannot buy this movie at the moment because it's on Netflix, which annoys me because I want to own this digitally, and I went to buy it last night and I could not.
I happen to own the Criterion release of The Rock.
Well, yeah. And you know what? While we're dropping that, I own the Criterion release of Armageddon.
Oh, man.
Because that's a real thing that happened.
Yeah.
And I have it.
Yeah. And that's a movie I hate. Yeah. I really fucking hate that movie.
We'll have a redemption for
man,
you here.
What a weird, that would be a weird double feature to watch the Criterion releases of The Rock and Armageddon back to back. And just for a moment, no matter what your feelings on either of those movies, simmer in the undeniable reality that both of those movies have Criterion releases.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about this cast. This cast. So of course, you know, whether you've seen the movie or not, you know this is a Sean Connery, Nicolas Cage movie. It's not really their movie, though.
It's not, but it is. I love the time capsule element of this movie, remembering that era in the late 90s, early 2000s, where Nicolas Cage could open blockbuster action movies.
Oh, yeah.
That was a very magical time for our country.
And Sean Connery stopped caring.
Yeah.
He really just stopped. I mean, the thing is, he just got old and people were making fun of him being old, but he really was just getting up there and he was still taking the paychecks and he just didn't care. So you got crazy Nicolas Cage and bored Sean Connery.
Which, and I think this is lightning in a bottle, completely accidental, makes this pairing.
Yes.
Because he actually grounds insane Nicolas Cage with his total apathy. Like, there is a moment in this movie that sold me on their relationship, not as characters, but as actors, and their dynamic as performers, is when the general is trying to flush them out, and he takes one of the hostages, puts a gun to his head, and is, like, broadcasting, like, I'm going to kill this guy if you don't come out, and Sean Connery's like, you go defuse the bomb, I'm going to buy you some time, and Nicolas Cage is like, what about the hostage? What about the hostage? And Sean Connery just turns around and just does a thumbs up and walks away, and I'm like, what a weird... Wait, what the fuck? What is that reaction? And I realize what it is him just going like, what the fuck, Evan, Nick? I don't understand a word you're saying. You're all over the... You're either whispering and you're screaming. I don't understand it. Whatever, fuck off. And it's like, yes, that's their relationship. Nicolas Cage swings for the fences and makes the most bonkers choice he can in every situation. And this Sean Connery is like, I don't have the fucking patience for you. Whatever.
It's fucking batshit. But the thing is that they make it work.
They make it work so well.
That chemistry works in a very weird way.
Chemistry.
That should not.
Chemical super freak.
Yes. Because, wow, both of these characters are unlikable fucking assholes.
And neither...
That they have to really work hard to make us like.
And if you really stop to think about it for 2 seconds... Neither one of them should be frontlining an action movie.
No.
At all.
No. No, especially after Firebirds. That shit should have been revoked on Nicolas Cage.
Nicolas Cage is the kind of guy who, in a real firefight, I imagine would retreat more than his hairline in this movie. And yet, he and old Sean Connery, because of very... This movie is a testament to great editing. Because of the editing... There's never a moment you don't buy it.
Right.
And that's a fucking miracle.
The editing, although, I may as well take a sidebar. The editing to this movie is super weird.
Sidebar.
Super weird. Because if you notice, the weird thing about The Rock is every edit happens like half a second too soon. like compared to normal modern editing. Like it just, it's so rapid fire. It cannot get out of its scenes fast enough. It cannot get out of its cuts fast enough. And what's so weird is we keep cutting back and forth between, hey, these guys are doing something, and let's just cut to the other team for a split second and have them deliver a line and cut out like the second that line's done to go into somebody else's line and kind of split second that line's done just so that we can ratchet up the tension a bit. And it's just so weird.
Well, that's because Michael Bay movies are, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but I think he was one of the first people to really do this. They're shot like music videos. They're shot with bare attention spans. And in fact, I don't know if you know this, but I subscribe to a foreign newspaper called the IMDb. And the IMDb tells me that the average shot length of this movie is less than 2.6 seconds.
Yeah.
The average shot length.
There's so many shots
under 3 seconds.
This movie, and it's just, and they cut out so quickly. It's so weird to watch in retrospect.
But like, that's because, I think part of that is because you have old Sean Connery and average as fuck physically Nicolas Cage, who are the action heroes of this movie.
In those moments, yeah, but the rest, which what we have not gotten into is the rest of this fucking junkie cast, all of whom fucking bring it.
Oh, yeah.
In this. And
they rock it, you might say.
And the thing is you don't need to cut away from actors like that quickly, but they do.
Yeah.
And it leaves a genuine impression. Like, everyone in this fucking cast leaves a fucking impression.
But there's so many great actors in this cast that it's almost like the editing is relating to us. There's just no time. We have no time. We have so many people we have to get to. So many awesome actors we have to show.
And let's rapid fire like Michael Bay run through it. So we've got Ed Harris already. And Ed Harris is there with his number one, fucking David Morse.
Awesome.
Who's just doesn't have a lot to do here, but brings everything that you love about David Morse. He is just lovable and huggable, even when he's playing a fucking guy threatening San Francisco with fucking VX gas.
Yeah.
Like, that is just, it's crazy.
Also, take a huge chugging drink, because the next time Nicolas Cage and David Morse work together is a little movie called Drive Angry, and there's no way we're not covering that movie at some point. Yes, we are. Continue.
We'll talk about Drive Angry.
Yes, we will.
We'll
on the
have
podcast.
A nice long talk about Drive Angry.
On the podcast.
And maybe there'll be a redemption involved in Drive Angry. but yeah, so that's not all. Who do they have working with them on their team, their super team? Like, this is probably the greatest, most lovable group of terrorists you have ever seen, because not only do we have Ed Harris, not only do we have David Morse, we've got John C. McGinley.
Oh my God.
Dr. Cox,
who before Scrubs spent a lot of his career playing SWAT guys, playing heavies, like physical heavies. He was the leader of the SWAT team in Seven as well.
We've got Bokeem Woodbine.
Yep.
We've got fucking Tony Todd.
Okay.
Tony Todd.
How badass is your military outfit when you have a guy named Candyman and that's not his fucking call sign? That's his actual name. He is the Candyman. Come on, folks.
Yeah, he's, I mean, it is just, that group itself is just crazy cool, where just every time a terrorist gets a line, you're like, oh, fuck yeah, man. Fuck yeah. So then we've got the Navy SEAL team. And the Navy SEAL team,
led by Navy SEAL star
Michael Biehn.
Okay, here's the thing. At this point, with the number of times he's cropped up on episodes, we should change the name of this show to Biehn There, Done That. He literally, like, every other week, it's like, and Michael Biehn as who cares because he's awesome. Let's just put him in the movie.
Because he's fucking awesome. Except that this is the one time where you see the heroic SEAL team and you got it led by Michael Biehn and you're like, this is the team I'm fine getting shot up.
Yes.
They are not nearly as cool as Ed Harris's terrorist unit. And that's
terrorists, I think they're called.
Yes.
Ed Harris.
Because it's Michael Biehn, it's Danny Nucci, who also, you know, was again part of this trilogy of Bruckheimer films. He's in Crimson Tide. They're like the SEAL team. You've got Steve Harris in there as one of the guys over, you know, the one of the support guys for the SEAL team. And this is just super, super crazy and junky. And on top of that, just because we've got John Spencer as FBI Director Womack, who is involved in this whole thing, who would later go on shortly after this. Up until this point, he was just a character actor who would show up and stuff and who's really reliable. And then right after this, he gets a little show called The West Wing, where he plays, you know, the chief of staff in and would that would be the show that he would be remembered for. Like, and so here we're seeing a little bit, we're seeing the weaselier version of that character.
Let us not forget that also playing a chief justice for the American government, uncredited in the movie, is Philip Baker Hall.
Yes, Philip Baker Hall shows up in that room.
Also, William Forsythe is in this movie.
As an FBI agent as well, because I was just getting to Team FBI.
Team FBI!
And then, because it was the 90s, and because she was one of the most beautiful women on the planet at the time, Claire Forlani, for a brief hot minute...
That's my favorite part of this movie is they're like, hey, you want to drive over to a Kevin Smith movie, see what he's up to? Yeah, just make a quick stop over to Kevin Smith movie. Hey, Claire Forlani's here. Of course she is.
Claire Forlani with daddy issues because it was the 90s. and then, oh my God, Vanessa, is it pronounced Marcy or Marchy?
I think it's Marchy, I want to say. Marchiel, maybe?
Holy God. Does she create a very weird element to this movie? Like, she is in just a small smidgen of this movie. She is only there to humanize Nick Cage because
somebody has to at some point.
They keep trying. Like, this movie tries so hard. They're like, I just spent $600 on vinyl because vinyl sounds better. And it's like, oh, you're a proto hipster. Yeah, that doesn't make, you spent $600 on a Beatles record. I guess you're kind of human.
Yeah.
No, you're Nick Cage. You're still an alien. And they keep trying things. And then she shows up and he's like naked playing guitar, trying to deconstruct the day that he almost got blown up.
Sure.
And
as we all do.
She walks in and gives the news that she's pregnant. And even then, he's still not really human, and they're trying. And then we get to this scene later, right before he gets the call that he needs to go. And it is this weirdly erotic sex scene that I'm just going to say drove women nuts at this era. I know a whole mess of guys who took girls to see The Rock, and all of them had experiences afterwards that they were just like, dude, she just attacked me.
Really?
Yes. It was
because
the weirdest
of that
thing.
Sex scene?
Yeah.
Okay, that
it's
is bizarre
the weirdest
to me.
Thing. Cause the energy of Nicolas Cage at the time and Sean Connery at the time mixed with that scene, there was this chemistry to this movie that got men in 1996 late. Like,
wow.
It was the weirdest thing. So
I want to go back for a second to something you were talking about with Nicolas Cage. I've had this long-standing theory about Nicolas Cage, which is that he's insane as a human being, and all of his choices that he makes in movies are thusly insane, and the worst Nicolas Cage movies are the ones where they try and make it seem like he's a normal guy.
Yes.
Where he's playing the Joe Everyman, because Nicolas Cage is about as far from Joe Everyman as it gets. This movie plays with the idea that he's just really quirky. They don't really... He is insane, don't get me wrong.
He's a super freak.
But the way the things that he's saying, the way they're presenting this character, it's like, oh, he's a chemistry geek, and he's just a little quirky. And that kind of mentality with Nicolas Cage is similar to walking outside and being like, oh, it's raining a little bit, and there's a fucking tornado headed toward your house that you're not looking at. It's like, yeah, he's a little quirky, sure. It's almost to that same level as like trying to normalize him. And when you say humanize, I feel like what they're actually trying to do is normalize him a little bit.
Yeah, normalize is
but
is
you
fine.
Can't do that. That's like trying to hold a fucking tiger back with a wooden chair. It's
but,
not going to happen.
But the reason I think it works so well in this movie is he's kind of the voice of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this movie is so fucking bonkers in terms of the concept of it that he's got to be there to be like, this is fucking crazy. There's no way this should be happening right now.
Well, although in this movie, for some weird, this has to be a Nicolas Cage decision. He would have said, this is friggin' crazy. Oh, golly gee, what the heck? Because throughout most of this movie, he's the one character who doesn't curse.
Because it's a PG-13 movie.
No. Everyone else is dropping F-bombs like crazy in this movie. Everyone else is swearing. He is the one character who's like friggin' this and friggin' that and like literally saying things like, gosh. Like she says, you know, you had this idea 7 seconds ago. And he says, well, gosh, kind of a lot's happened in the last 7 seconds. It's crazy to me that he's the one character in this movie who is like anti-profanity until the end. Of course, he has a couple of like when he's killing a couple of the guys.
You know, now I'm trying to remember.
I'm pretty sure this is R. Because
there's not really anything R.
Rated R for strong violence, language, and a sex scene. Apparently, and a sex scene that will get you attacked when you get home was the full description, according to the MPAA.
It doesn't show anything, though. Like, there's no nudity in this movie.
But there is.
There's not really blood in this movie.
There is an exorbitant amount of cursing, and the violence in this movie. You literally, the opening of the, well, the second opening of this movie.
Oh, yeah.
A man's face melting.
I forget about the melting scene.
Like, somebody opens the Ark of the Covenant or something. I mean, that guy's face, like, bubbles into nothing.
Like, the thing it said extreme violence, right?
Mm-hmm.
The opening action scene is a bunch of guys getting darted.
Aha, because we have a villain. I love that we have not really talked about the plot of this movie.
We'll get there. Let me finish this.
Yeah, go for it.
So we've got the opening where these guys get darted. Then we've got a car chase where we don't see anyone get injured. We have a scene in which a bunch of Navy SEALs get gunned down. But it's all rapid. It's just firing back and forth. There's no real blood per se. And then we have terrorists getting, you know, killed off, but not in really bloody ways either. So, in fact, in kind of ridiculous ways at times, beautifully so. Extreme violence. This is not, especially for that era, this is not an extremely violent movie.
But who are we to question the wisdom of the MPAA? Clearly a perfect entity and would never make a mistake. No, surely not. No, but you're right.
Infallible? Is that
infallible
the word
entity?
For?
Yeah, that's the word we're looking for. Words Brian
so infallible.
Words Brian couldn't remember for 200, Alex. You fucking Canadian punts. But yeah, it's not that they're graphic, but there's a straight up Roger Rabbit death in this movie
where an air conditioning unit
is dropped on a guy's head, and the point of impact is so like, boom, done.
There are two Roger Rabbit deaths because another guy gets a missile in the chest.
Oh my God. Tony Todd goes for a ride is the children's picture book I'm putting together. But you know what? If he had survived that, it would have been annoying because he would have just been talking about how death follows him all the time now, and he would have become a morgue worker, and it would have just been annoying. So should we talk a little about the plot since we're about halfway through the show
this
now?
This is the fucking Rock. Look, long story short.
Long story short has never been Michael Bay's style.
Yeah. This is terrorists take over Alcatraz with VR gas, and the good guys have to break in, so they have to get a guy out of prison who was the only guy to ever break out of Alcatraz. But since everyone knows that no one ever broke out of Alcatraz, we have to make up a conspiracy theory about the guy that nobody's heard of that did. So, and they break in to try to stop the gas. That is the plot of this movie. And for some reason, they make it gripping and absurdly entertaining for 2 hours and 16 minutes.
Now, as the entertainment value, what I found interesting in my research in the IMDb was that when Michael Bay, during the writing process of this movie, the original script was, you know, you talked about him making, or Bruckheimer making action dramas. It was written much more straight and serious. And a lot of the comedy came from ad-libbing on set, which I have to believe a lot of it came from Nicolas Cage, who, according to commentaries I've watched on his other movies, is the loosest of loose cannons on set. But it's funny to think about what this movie would have been if there hadn't been that ad-libbing, because so much of this movie's comedy comes from just Nicolas Cage and Sean Connery trying to work together. And on top of that, or perhaps running right up against that, is, as we talked about at the top of the show, this moral ambiguity and this actually deeply complex antagonist played by Ed Harris, who is sick and tired of soldiers who die in covert ops not being given, their families aren't given benefits, they're not given proper burials, they're told lies about what happened, and he's fed up with it. And what
he's fed up with is corruption in government.
Yes,
he is upset with politicians covering their asses for decisions they make and the American heroes that die. Like, that's what's so interesting here is we have a conservative terrorist, a politically conservative terrorist who is a true patriot. Like, he is a guy who so loves his country that he is willing to go down in history as a villain for the legacy of these men that have died under his command, his country has forgotten. Like, it is such a wonderfully drawn hero. And then the choices he makes later in the movie are so interesting.
Yeah.
And so different from any other fucking movie you watch. Like, that is what is so fascinating about this movie is you have not, like, The Rock seems like in memory and the way film history remembers it as a boilerplate model for an action movie. And there is nothing boilerplate about this movie. Every choice it makes is radically different from every other type of action movie.
Yeah, I mean, I love the fact that you have this movie and then you have Con Air. Both movies start with these sort of forced montages about special ops, about Marines, about what the military does, about these units that in Con Air feels very masturbatory. Like, here's what an Army Ranger is, and you have no idea how fucking powerful an Army Ranger is. They're in fact so powerful that their hands are lethal weapons and they'll go to, which is bullshit, whatever. This movie starts with
Don't you talk shit about Army Rangers.
I'm not talking shit about Army Rangers. I'm talking
You will run into one that listens to the podcast.
Don't put that on me. That's not at all what I was saying. I'm saying it's bullshit that
you're going to get your ass kicked
because of this person who throws up smoke screens and gaslights Republicans. No, because what's bullshit is the government telling him you're not allowed to defend yourself because your hands are lethal weapons. That's what's bullshit. Yes, that's not a thing.
No, I'm just giving you a hard time because that's our show.
The court system would never say to an Army Ranger like, "Well, you're not bound by the laws of this country because your body is a lethal weapon," because that sounds like a porn. No, but this movie starts with a montage that you think is that until you realize that what it's actually establishing is the fact that Ed Harris, prior to jumping to this radical solution, tried to go through the appropriate channels to protest to the Pentagon what was happening to these soldiers. So we really are presented with a character who you can't really blame.
No, and the thing is when we see him, he goes in the rain to visit his wife's grave and explain to his dead wife why he's about to do what he's going to do and ask her forgiveness beforehand. Like, that's who this guy is. Like, this guy, there is more soul in Ed Harris's character than any other fucking character in this movie. And the choices he makes from then on are all make sense. That's why I call him the antagonist. He's not a villain in this movie. The villain in this movie are the mercenaries he ends up hiring because he doesn't have a full crew and they came recommended. The guys he trusts mostly stand by him.
And the guys he trusts also are very aware of the limits of this mission. Of the lines he will not cross. It's like, of course he's not actually going to kill innocent people in San Francisco. Of course he's not going to actually execute these hostages. It's a smokescreen.
Yeah.
But when these other guys that he takes on find that out, we realize that they're willing to cross those lines.
Because they were in it for the money.
They were in it for the money, and they are the real actual villains of this movie. And meanwhile, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are still trying to figure shit out on the fringe of the story. And when Ed Harris's character, spoiler alert, gets murdered by these other mercenaries, it's tragic. You feel bad for the guy who set this all up in the first place.
Yeah. No, and that's because of these various choices. We have that opening scene where they steal the gas, and they're only using darts. They're not killing any of the guys on the base. They won't kill any of the guys on the base. When there is the shootout between the SEAL team and his team, he's screaming the whole time to stop firing. And he's trying to save these guys' lives. He wants these guys to turn around and go back, or he wants to detain them. He doesn't want to kill the Navy SEALs, but the Navy SEALs are not going to back the fuck down. And so what you have is this total machismo battle that ends up somebody knocks over some rubble and everyone starts firing. He's like, no, 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 I didn't want this. No. So he's doing that. And then when it comes down to it's time to fire the missile, he veers the missile off and buries it in the water. And it's like, oh, yeah, he's not going to do it. And they're like, what the fuck are you doing? We have to kill some people. And he's like, no, they called our bluff. Like, it's done. Like,
this is over.
It's over. And every choice he makes was just the fact that he was never going to hurt anyone.
Right.
And that the only reason people get, and this is what I love about this. This is what I love about this trilogy of films that Bruckheimer made. It's really morally ambiguous because ultimately the only villain, the real villains in this movie are the mercenaries, which are kind of side villains, and the government. The government falsely, you know, and improperly imprisoned one of our characters. Mm-hmm. They mistreated American heroes. And then ultimately the government's bad choices lead to everyone who dies in this movie. Like, had the government made the correct choices, done the right things, nobody would have gotten hurt. But the government doesn't do that. And that is, you know, because, and a lot of these guys, it's because they're in the dark. A lot of these guys, it's to protect their own asses. Mm-hmm. You know, it's why do they, you know, why is the government worried about this $100 million from this slush fund that doesn't really exist, that is only used for bullshit reasons?
It's the money they got from illegal arms deals. So it's like, yeah, I mean, like the level of shade that this movie is throwing at the government is pretty spectacular.
Womack is one of the bad guys in this movie, the actual bad guys, because of the bullshit he's done. And yet this movie makes you care about him because John Spencer's great. When he gets flung over the side of a building and held aloft and almost dropped, like, it's so interesting how the Bruckheimer of this era was creating these characters. He does it in Crimson Tide, where he's got a clear protagonist in that movie, but there's actually this really subtle stuff going on in that movie that neither of the guys are right. Like, we'll talk about it when we get to Crimson Tide, but like right down to the Olympus Honor Stallions, where there's this information in that movie that they're arguing over. And if you actually look it up, they're both actually wrong about the Olympus Honor Stallions. And that's the point. But the movie never tells you outright, hey, by the way, they were both wrong on this. And that's very much what's going on here. You think you're watching a movie about these two action heroes, and no, you're not. You're watching a movie that's all about corruption in the government and how good men are put on opposing sides as a result. And that is what this whole movie is about. And it's so likable and so fascinating at every turn. But the real villains here are a couple of mercenaries and a couple of government stooges covering their ass. That's who the only bad guys in this movie are. Ed Harris is not the bad guy.
No, and the movie deals with very elegantly it's not really elegant. It's a fucking Reservoir Dogs massacre. But I like the way the script absolves the audience of having to judge either Ed Harris or, you know, having to pick a side, essentially. It absolves the audience of the responsibility of picking a side, which I think is great.
Yeah.
And very much sets this apart from a lot of action movies of this era that are sometimes accused of being, like, this movie is accused of being like a knockoff of Die Hard or this or that. And it's like, this movie is so much more interesting, because imagine if in Die Hard you were rooting for both John McClane and Hans Gruber at the same time.
Yeah. What if Hans Gruber was actually stealing back money that was taken illegally by Nakatomi?
The Nakatomi Corporation is the bad guy of the movie.
If we find out that Nakatomi is essentially Nestle and they've been doing awful things in Africa, and he's taking that money back so that he can then give it back to the country it was stolen from.
Which is the most heinous part, by the way, in this comparison. The most heinous thing about Hans Gruber is he's pretending to be political.
Yes.
He's pretending to give a shit about imprisoned political activists. He doesn't fucking care.
Which is why we love watching Alan Rickman die in slow motion. Like, that shot is so amazing because of that. Here, this is just the opposite. Comparing this to Die Hard, just because it's a guy who doesn't belong in a situation,
He says something about Asian Dawn, and he's like, I saw them on 60 Minutes, I don't know. And just keeps going back to pretending to care about all these political prisoners. Like, that's the most heinous thing about him, is it's all for personal gain under the guise of being a political criminal, whereas it's the complete opposite for somebody like Ed Harris.
Ed Harris is willing to sacrifice his own life and liberty and reputation, a reputation he has built as a hero, for these people who are dead and their families. Like, that's it. That is and the money that they're taking for themselves is to get them out of the country to a non-extradition treaty country and live there and live their lives, never being able to return home. It's just enough money to essentially get by for the rest of your life. None of these guys are getting rich,
right?
Which is why it's so weird that the mercenaries are willing to do it for so little money. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the only, if you're going to talk about like character logic in this movie, that money is such a small amount for these guys to be willing to do this for, that it's so weird that they're willing. But maybe it's just
that's what those families are owed. It's like the exact amount those families are owed, and it's not a penny more. I mean, it actually kind of gels with
the motivations. I'm talking about like the mercenaries who are we're doing this for the money. Like, we're getting our money. I feel like it's almost there, but that they make it feel like it's about the money so much that it's not, you know, I feel like it needed one line. Like, if there's any flaw to this movie, it needed one line of them going, we're way too far into this. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to prison, and us not having succeeded.
Which is ironic considering their home base is a fucking prison.
Right.
I would buy that entirely. I would also, you know what else I would buy? Had it existed, I would have bought the 16-bit video game version of The Rock.
Oh, God.
Like, I'm kind of fascinated by video game adaptations of movies that shouldn't exist, like the Lawnmower Man video game for Super Nintendo, which is a real thing. Yeah, it's real.
Oh, or the Toxic Avenger video game I bought you for your birthday several years ago.
I would play the shit out of a Super Nintendo Rock video game where you could literally choose at the beginning whether you
Genesis
wanted to play
Rock.
Oh,
Genesis.
Yes, because it would function like the Genesis Jurassic Park game where you could choose either Stanley Goodspeed or Sean Connery, whose character name isn't important because he's John Mason, but he's Sean Connery for fuck's sake, James Bond. Where you could choose either one of them, and depending on which one you choose, it's like that changes your missions. You're either defusing rockets or you're snapping necks if you're Sean Connery. But then you have the level where you're like on a mine cart and you're like having to dodge a flaming John C. McGinley or whatever, what have you. And you would have like the level where you take on Tony Todd and like you send him out on a rocket, and just you have the level where you're sneaking through if you're Sean Connery, you have to roll through the actual boiler to get into the rock. Like, I would have played the shit out of that game.
Oh,
this should have had a game.
You know what the best part would be? That whenever you screw up with the gas, mm-hmm. you actually watch just all the digital bits kind of get just peel off your skeleton.
Pixelate, melting.
Melt, yeah. That
Can you imagine Nicolas Cage in that recording booth recording dying sounds? Like, just like, oh. And every time there's like a cutaway scene, because it's 16-bit, there's not like, you don't have like moving like mini video cutaway scenes. It would just be a picture of Nicolas Cage's crazy ass face and then a bunch of text under it. And you could use shots from other Nicolas Cage movies, like fucking Vampire's Kiss. Like, oh, we gotta find the VX gas rockets. But the whole time it's just his face from Vampire's Kiss. I would have played the shit out of the game. Where is that game?
I don't know. I'm actually looking it up just to make
just
sure.
Just to make sure.
Because last time we did this, it's like, why isn't there a Guardians of the Galaxy cartoon?
Yes.
Oh, there is, and it's not good.
We don't believe in fact-checking.
we just kind of riff sometimes.
We
pull boners.
Hey, we are part of the mainstream media, and as such, we are not required to fact-check anything. Haven't you read Twitter? That's what's going on. No, I want to talk about something you said about what this movie feels like and the connection to Tony Scott, because this was the last movie to be produced by, and we talked about Bruckheimer, but there's another part to that equation. The other part of that equation is Don Simpson. Don Simpson died actually during the post-production on this movie, purportedly of a drug overdose, though I think the official cause of death was listed as a heart attack. But Don Simpson is a man who is very largely responsible for Tony Scott's career. I mean, if you look at the movies that Don Simpson produced, Top Gun, Beverly Hills Cop 2, Days of Thunder, Crimson Tide, all Tony Scott's biggest movies.
Oh, yeah.
So,
and yeah, no, the Simpson, Bruckheimer, they and Tony Scott kind of pioneered the slick action films. Like, mm-hmm. There's a reason why Bruckheimer has the power and reputation that he has, and he made so many careers, and it came from what Simpson, Bruckheimer, and Simpson, Bruckheimer, by the way, started out as a pair of just indie producers that produced a huge gargantuan hit that cost no money called Flashdance.
Yep.
And Flashdance, then with all that money, they went and they fucking made Top Gun, and bam, there it was. And and then they became the kings of the techno thrillers, and then Don Simpson died very young from a heart attack, which everybody knows was for a... could you do your Joel Silver impression again? Because, you know, that never gets old.
Where the fuck is Don? He was supposed to be here with the... I don't care if I sound like a pessimist. This bag is half empty. Where is Don? Somebody get Don!
Yeah. So yes, this was this, and this is the one, the In Loving Memory film. This is the, he has passed away, and this is the first film that Bruckheimer had to go it alone. But yeah, this era, and I'm wondering, because this era is just so particular, how much influence Don Simpson had in the development of these movies over time, that he may have been the, because I know that Bruckheimer has a hard-on for the American hero. Mm-hmm. Like, that is very much, like, he was very much, like, you know, military good, you know.
The loving shots of helicopters flying overhead in almost every movie that Bruckheimer produces should clue you in on that.
The thing is it's great. You know, having grown up in a military household, I'm a military brat. I feel like Bruckheimer was one of the very first guys to really get... the sense of blue-collar patriotism that actually exists in the military, and how much the people that are in the military really love the country. System, you know, in the Hollywood system, that usually paints the military as the bad guys. Like, they are the overbearing bad guys. Like, these guys are dumb as rocks and do what they're ordered to do. Not that they do what they're ordered to do because they love their country and will disobey an order if it's against their country, kind of thing. So Bruckheimer had this love of the military, but these films have a very strong distrust of the government. Mm-hmm. Like, we love the guys who do the job. We don't trust the guys that give them the orders. And that's so interesting, and that's so prevalent in this era. It's why I call it kind of a trilogy, because that is very much what is brought up in Crimson Tide.
Oh, to the nth degree.
And in G.I. Jane, where G.I. Jane is this film that is very much about, which is very much about using this girl as a political pawn to score points, and then when she turns out to be fucking Superwoman and be fucking awesome and belong there, everyone's trying to run her out, and it's and it deals with moral ambiguity of feminism in the 90s, and it's so interesting the way these three movies all kind of fall together with a mm-hmm. mistrust of the government, but a very much a the people on the ground, you know, the people in the mud, these people are our heroes. And so it's really interesting. And this one is so this, you know, we've got the good FBI agent with the bad political, you know, the bad guy in the FBI is just the political appointee, you know, the head of the FBI, Womack. You've got, the fact that, Sean Connery, even though he was a spy, he's a good guy because he was fighting for his country, and he never gave up his country. You know,
this is what happens when James Bond gets caught.
Yeah. You know, all the bad guys here are government types. All the good guy, all the people down the rungs, the FBI agents are good guys. You know, the military men who were under Ed Harris's command are the good guys. You know, it's so interesting how he paints this. That you don't have, like, the only people who are bad guys that are the military guys are the mercenaries, the guys mm-hmm. who are brought in.
And those guys, holy shit, do they die. Like,
do they really
die? Holy shit. Like, at the end of the movie, you know, of course, we talked about the fact that Tony Todd gets the famous, like, it's you. You're the Rocket Man. Rocket Man, burning out the fuse of heaven long. and then gets a literal rocket, like, knocks him out a window, and you would think, oh, he'll explode, the fall will kill him. No, then he gets impaled on a rusty fence post.
Yeah.
Like, that guy dies twice.
That's a Wile E. Coyote death.
That's a Wile E. Coyote death. Like,
it's like we had called it a Roger Rabbit. No, that's a Wile E. Coyote death.
If this were a Wile E. Coyote cartoon, he would have gotten off of it and been standing profile and then turned toward the camera, and there just would have been a hole in the middle of him, like, uh-oh. And then, of course, his second in command gets a ball of VX gas shoved in his mouth and then punched so that it breaks. It is like, it's like on par for me with Dalton ripping somebody's throat out. It's just like, oh, it's, God, yeah. Oh, fuck.
Yeah.
Especially since they went through all the trouble to show us the incredible melting man at the beginning of the movie and what happens with that gas.
How many outtakes do you imagine there are of Nicolas Cage going, well, that'll leave a bad taste in your mouth.
That'll leave a bad taste in your mouth. Speaking of things that, your mouth, the things that come out of Nicolas Cage's mouth in this movie, when he, like, the mercenary that threatens, and he says, like, I'd take pleasure in gutting you, boy, and then Nicolas Cage spends about 5 minutes just repeating that line over and over again.
I'd take pleasure in gutting you, boy. I'll take pleasure in gutting you, boy. What's wrong with these people, huh, Mason? Don't you think there's a lot of anger flowing around this island? Kind of a pubescent volatility, don't you think? A lot of angst, a lot of 16, I'm angry at my father syndrome. I mean, grow up! We're stuck on an island with a bunch of violence for pleasure-seeking psychopathic Marines. Shame on them!
To talk about the unnecessary hostility of, like, military guys, and it's just like, the fuck are you talking about? What is happening right now? But that's why we love Nicolas Cage, because in any given movie, playing any given character, you never know what the fuck he's going to do. And I understand why it's raised the debate of whether Nicolas Cage is a good actor. I think that debate is irrelevant, because I think Nicolas Cage is one of the most interesting actors that has ever lived. Like, even in his worst movies, you will not stop talking about the performance of Nicolas Cage. You, like, the Wicker Man remake is garbage. Absolutely. It's nigh unwatchable. But what makes it kind of watchable is Nicolas Cage's completely over-the-top batshit performance. In fact, batshit may be a term invented by Nicolas Cage in Vampire's Kiss, because what the fuck is that? Nobody knows what the director of that movie doesn't know what that movie's about. He said so in a commentary. So I love watching Nicolas Cage, no matter what the movie is, because he is going to do something interesting. He's going to make a choice that you will not comprehend. I don't think he's from this planet. He may actually be an alien.
You know, I have to address this real quick. I've been pulling a boner all episode.
Oh, no.
And it was something I just realized.
You know what my favorite thing to do is? Just pull a boner.
I keep referring to G.I. Jane as being part of this trilogy.
Yes. Yeah, sure.
And it's not.
It's not.
It is not. It was not a Bruckheimer movie. And I keep, like, it keeps coming out of my mouth. And I was like, wait a second. No, I grouped that in because it's Ridley Scott. And, you know, of course, Tony Scott made, you know, these two movies that I'm talking about. Well, Crimson Tide. And the third film that I keep referring to, I keep saying G.I. Jane. What I keep meaning is Enemy of the State, which I referenced earlier.
Yeah,
Enemy of the State is the other Bruckheimer, Tony Scott movie. So, yeah, sorry about it. I keep G.I. Jane fits into that whole mold, and it is a Ridley Scott movie. But the other paranoid government, you know, movie is, of course, Enemy of the State. And that's like that's the kind of end of Bruckheimer's era of the movies that feel and look and sound exactly like this. Sorry about that whole G.I. Jane business.
You know, if we're wearing blindfolds and we pull each other's boners, it's not gay.
Yeah,
don't know if you knew that.
Sean Connery needs to go away now. Yeah. I feel bad enough having made that blunder for the concept of this episode, but now you're making it worse and making me feel dirty listening to you talk like that. So
just filthy.
It's Enemy of the State that I'm talking about. That is the trilogy of these paranoid movies.
Yeah, paranoid techno thrillers. Yeah.
But dear God, this movie.
So good. The depth of character in the antagonist, the amazing, possibly accidental, perfect working relationship between Sean Connery and Nicolas Cage, who, by the way, at this point, are both actors known for being difficult.
You think?
Yeah. I mean, Sean Connery literally made the production team build him a cabin on Alcatraz Island because he got tired of taking the boat every day. They built him a fucking house on Alcatraz. Come on. Like, that's insane. Not to mention the fact this is a weirdo alternate universe version of this movie that is actually kind of controversial, because there is one story that says that Arnold Schwarzenegger was initially offered the John Mason role. There's another story that says, no, it wasn't the John Mason role, it was the Stanley Goodspeed role, which makes even less sense. But apparently, Schwarzenegger has said in a Reddit AMA that he regrets not taking the Sean Connery role in this movie, and the reason he didn't take it is apparently when he was offered, the script was only 80 pages long. So nobody really had any idea what this movie was going to be, but once Nicolas Cage signed on, that made Sean Connery sign on, who, by the way, went to bat a few times for Michael Bay with Disney. Which is crazy when you think about how all the stories you hear about Sean Connery being difficult to work with, having feuds with directors. He fucking went to bat. Almost literally, he brought a golf club into a meeting with Disney and basically told them to get off Michael Bay's back. He's doing a great job.
And he was. And the thing is, we have not talked a lot about Bay. We talked about Bruckheimer in more in this episode.
Well, because Bruckheimer and Simpson are the reason Bay exists. They plucked this kid out of doing music videos and produced his two first and biggest hits, Bad Boys and this movie.
Yeah.
The movies that set him on the path to being the action mainstay that he is now.
But the reason I've spent so much time on it is when you just listen to and watch this movie, it fucking sounds exactly like and looks exactly like Crimson Tide.
Yeah.
Like it is a spiritual sequel to Crimson Tide. Like this is why I keep grouping these together. Like, you know, put them on back to back and you'll just be like, Jesus Christ. Like, these movies, like the way they're cut, the way they're shot, you know, it's where open, you know, both of them open up at a military base in the rain. Mm-hmm. People coming onto the base in the exact same way, you know, the da 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 da.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
And the way they shoot all the daylight scenes, like everything about these movies look and feel the same. This is Michael Bay aping Tony Scott more than it is Michael Bay being Michael Bay. Like, Michael Bay would slowly, you know, create the style that he is known for, but this is the least Bay of the Bays. This is the more Bruckheimer of the Bays, and we have since seen what he really does unfettered. And when he's let loose, boy, is he the fucking Nicolas Cage of fucking directors. Like, he gets delightfully batshit at times where you're just like, this is crank to 11. Like, fuck it, there are women running around in bikinis and people snorting coke and, you know, close up of, you know, in a club, and all that was in 3 seconds, because that's Michael Bay. But
yeah,
but I do think his Michael Bay's influence here is just how quickly the edits are. Like, that is above all else, because you don't see that as much in Crimson Tide. Tony Scott, while a fast editing guy, took his time a little more than Michael Bay does here. Mm-hmm. Like, Michael Bay seems to want to get out of every shot faster than he should. But at the same time, you're never bored
for
2 hours and 16
this
minutes.
This movie is... Two hours and 16 minutes, you said?
2 hours and 16 minutes, and this movie is... And, like, you don't get to the end of the first act till minute 48. Like, minute 48 is usually, in any other movie, it is, the false victory or the first defeat. Like, that is just what happens at minute 45. And here... our two guys have just decided we're going to go into Alcatraz together. Like, we see Stanley Goodspeed save the cat by being a cool guy to Mason and, getting him his moment with his daughter and taking him away after this big action sequence. And really, this is the start of the fucking movie. Mm-hmm. It's a movie about going into Alcatraz. We don't even fucking go into Alcatraz in the first hour.
Yeah.
Like, and we're just setting up we're going to go into Alcatraz. And then we start getting the shit together and we get into the second act of the movie. But this movie, it's like, really, the first 25 minutes is mostly about Ed Harris and his plot. Mm-hmm. We get 2 minutes with Stanley Goodspeed, you know, being a dude, and then defusing a bomb, and that is fucking it.
Yeah.
And there's this weird zany way we meet him where it's literally just these weird cuts back and forth of him in his office being bored and
making Rube Goldberg machines.
Yeah, with his partner. It's such a weirdly structured thing, but it's never boring. Like, this movie is just bam, 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 bam. And you don't realize that the movie has it, because that's the thing, is one of the reasons why movies tend to be structured on the, you know, the three act structure and have the, you know, the first act done by the first 25 minutes is that's what the audience expects. And by minute 20, 25 is when the audience starts asking themselves, do I like this movie?
Yeah.
And this is where you usually figure out whether you're enjoying what you're watching or not enjoying what you're watching. And so you kind of need to let the audience know what the fuck this movie is about.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie doesn't really tell you what the fuck this movie is about until about 48 minutes in, where you're just like, oh, these two guys are going to be together and these two guys are going to go into Alcatraz together. And that's just what's going to happen. And you are in it the whole time.
Yeah.
And then by the time you're ramped up, you're like, all right, let's go. And then you still have almost a full movie's length of movie left.
Yeah.
Like, it's crazy. And the thing is that quick style keeps it going that whole time, and you're never bored and you're deep in it. And if you actually had all this stuff that's in this fucking movie and stayed a little longer with each bit, as other directors would do, you'd have a 2 hour 45 minute epic fucking movie.
Well, how could you possibly be bored? I mean, Bam 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 is correct. I mean, speaking of the talk of the bay, the thing that would make this movie fun is all of the amazing action that this movie has. It adds on top of that things that make the movie legitimately great, in my opinion. But holy God, that car chase where Sean Connery has commandeered a Hummer and is just crashing down like he's fucking Bullet going down the streets of the hills of San Francisco. There is a moment where a telephone pole falls over the street, and what proceeds to happen is Michael Bay starts chucking cars like he's the Incredible Hulk.
Oh, yeah.
Just like flipping and flying. It's like, holy fuck.
And this is where
And
this is where we get like the Michael Bayisms. Like, this is most of the Michael Bayisms are in this scene, where you've got, you know, wacky crazy guy like yelling swear words about his trolley car getting destroyed, and then you got, oh dude, your car.
Yeah.
It's not my car.
It's not my car. And then he takes the bike. Hilarious.
But neither is this.
Yeah.
Like, it's like those are the Bayisms, where it's just like, let's have this crazy mayhem and then let's giggle in the middle of it. That's the Michael Bay.
You know what? As I think about it, even having revisited it very recently, I don't think there's a spinny cam shot in this movie. Is there a spinny cam shot in this? I don't think there's a spinny cam shot in this movie. The only scene I can imagine it would have been in, I'm pretty sure, is just quick cuts back and forth. It's the scene where Ed Harris and Michael Biehn are yelling at each other, trying to get the other to surrender, and it keeps cutting back and forth between them, but I don't think it's like on a pivot. That's, I think, normally where in a Michael Bay movie you would see that, but I don't think it happens.
There's half a shot like that down in the sewers.
Okay.
It feels very, it's a shot that every time I see it, I always think Will Smith should be standing there. Like, it's that shot.
You think that maybe shit might have gotten real? Yeah, okay.
Like, it's shot like that, but it doesn't have the resonance and it's not a memorable shot. It's just one of those that I remember because I'm like, Will Smith should be here, and then it would be epic.
Yeah.
Man, could you imagine?
Oh, yes, I can.
Will Smith as Stanley Goodspeed in this?
Yeah. Yeah, I totally can. But you know what? That chemistry doesn't work.
No.
Because what you've just described is Men in Black. The chemistry between him and Sean Connery would be
exactly what it would be.
Men in Black. Whereas with Nicolas Cage, it's not an upstart trying to prove himself. It's a guy in over his head completely who's just trying to keep the situation from boiling over.
Yeah.
And therefore having the allowance to go completely bug nuts at times. And meanwhile, you've got Sean Connery, who just, actor and character, could not give a shit at all.
Yeah.
And that works. Like, despite itself, it really does work. So I would love to imagine Will Smith in this, but I think that would mute what makes this movie so great. And this movie is great. Don't get it twisted. This movie is absolutely fantastic. And like, yeah, there are moments that are silly. I mean, it's a Michael Bay film, but there's also some really deep, complicated stuff that I feel, like you said, is very much the Tony Scott remnants of this movie, because Tony Scott was offered this movie and he declined to make The Fan. So there's that.
Yeah, that's the Tony Scott movie you never hear me mention.
Yeah, the Tony Scott movie people
because
are
I
like,
I am one of the world's biggest Tony Scott fans, and even I'm like,
well,
yeah.
When you bring up The Fan, people have two questions. What is that? And Tony Scott directed that? And then what is that again? So there's actually three questions.
Yeah, but he redeem himself after that with a series of awesome fucking movies.
Oh, of course he did. Of course he did.
Yeah. But yeah, so that's The Rock, guys. The Rock is fucking, it's a wonderfully quirky paranoid thriller that doesn't seem paranoid, but really is. One of the things I love most about it. It's so structurally complicated. It's so weird and unlike any other film, not only of its era of today. You could not make this film today.
Yeah.
You couldn't be this jingoistic and paranoid of the government at the same time. You can't. Like, it's...
You can't have your cake and wear a tinfoil hat, too.
Like, yeah, it's... It would... It... Because this kind of jingoism turns off a lot of folks.
Jingo!
In this day and age. Because they imagine that if you're being jingoistic, if you're showing a flag waving in the breeze, that it's not you're a patriot that loves America, it's that you're a right-wing Republican.
It's a false flag.
That is selling us a brand of America. You can't, like, people just get turned off with it. It's kind of like even what's going on today in culture where even Christians kind of wince if somebody goes, well, you know, as a Christian, you're one of those. Like, it's becoming, like, people are getting turned off.
People are Christ-splaining things too much. Is that what's happening in social media right now?
Don't do that.
That's a thing. That should totally be a thing.
But no, I feel like this kind of jingoism just cannot. It doesn't sell anymore. It doesn't connect. People think there's something behind it. And that's what I love about this era of these Bruckheimer movies, is that it's a movie. They're movies that love their country and don't trust the people running it. And it's something that plays to all of us because that's how we always feel. And depending on who's in power, it's a very different thing. I think we might see it a lot more coming out of Hollywood now that, you know, once you hear this episode, unless you cut it really early and we manage to get it out on time, we're going to have a different president and you know, one that Hollywood's not a fan of, I do really love this notion of these movies that really do love its soldiers and don't trust the guys giving them orders. And it was just such a weird, interesting period of cinema history. And we will cover the rest of it. We will talk about G.I. Jane at some point, despite the fact that it's, he's shaking his head.
No, I'm shaking my head because I think you did it again.
No. Okay. I was about to say, despite the fact that it is not a Bruckheimer film, we will talk about Enemy of the State because, dear God, I love Enemy of the State. We will talk about Crimson Tide, because why the fuck haven't we talked about Crimson Tide?
Of course we're
going to
talk about Crimson
Tide. I introed that at Convergence last year. They asked me if I wanted to intro a movie, and I was like, yeah, you're showing Crimson Tide. Fuck yeah. And I went and gave my 10-minute midnight, because it was a midnight movie, and I was so happy that it was a midnight, and I gave my...
You worm-splained it to everybody?
I gave my half-drunk, super excited, oh my God, how many people here have seen Crimson... Like, 100 people showed up to watch Crimson Tide at midnight, and I said, how many people have seen this? And three hands go up, and I'm like, oh my God, you guys are so fucking lucky.
I think every time you start a rant now, I'm going to play a soundbite of Chaz Palminteri from A Bronx Tale going,
now you just can't leave.
Just like, lock the doors, guys. You can't leave.
you can't leave this podcast yet.
You're in now.
But yeah, we're definitely going to cover this whole era of, you know, really slick, big budget, jingoistic, paranoid movies, like, because it's just, I love all of these films and I love this era, and so many great directors did so many great things, and we got Michael Bay's best movie out of this.
Yeah.
What do you say we cut the chit chat, a-hole?
Well, that brings us to the junk food pairing, and this week I am going to highly recommend that you drink yourself some vaporized whiskey, and by drink I mean inhale yourself some vaporized whiskey while sitting in a beige Volvo. We talked about how this is part of a paranoid thriller trilogy. It's also the beige Volvo trilogy. in this movie, Stanley Goodspeed talks about how he's just a, I'm just a biochemist. I drive a beige Volvo. And it's, okay. And in The Rock, he happens to drop Pinball, Dave Chappelle, out of a plane. He crashes onto a beige Volvo.
Wait, no, you said The Rock.
I'm sorry, in Con Air.
Con Air.
And then in Face Off, right after he escapes from the floating prison, he steals a beige Volvo. So this is, I believe, the first of the three Nicolas Cage beige Volvo trilogies movies. But getting back to the actual junk food pairing, you can actually vaporize alcohol now, which is crazy to me. And the way it's served is actually in a glass ball, much like the String of Pearls configuration of the VX gas in The Rock. So it won't make your face melt, but after a while, you may not be able to feel it. So I would highly recommend having yourself some vaporized whiskey while watching The Rock.
You know what? That is, I did not vaporize it, but while I watched The Rock again, I did it with three different whiskeys. One whiskey and two scotches. I had a bunch of bottles that from having people over the holidays all just had not enough to share with anybody else. And so I literally, I had a little bit of Buffalo Trace left. I had a little bit of that Oban left from last week's episode. And I had a little bit of, because did we do some damage to that bottle last week. And then I had to open another bottle. And so I ended up having three different types of whiskeys last night while I watched The Rock. And it was wonderful. The Rock and whiskey goes hand in hand. So I agree with this week's junk food pairing.
It won't kill you. That should actually be one of the taglines of this podcast. Hey, it won't kill you. And speaking of things that won't kill you, you can find more of us on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. And you can like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter at Massaworm, MassaWyrm, or on Facebook, facebook.com/Massaworm.
All right. You can find me on Twitter at Bri Guy Salisbury. You can also find my Facebook page, Brian Salisbury Critic. And you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema and please help support the show. Just throw a few shekels into the hat. It really does benefit us, helps us keep doing this in the first place. So if you like what we're doing, it's a great way to ensure that we stick around for a while. So please consider becoming a patron. And I want to remind you all before we go that losers always whine about their best. Winners go home and drink three types of whiskey while watching The Rock.